What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Right now in Fast, Jamie Dimon and JP Morgan scoop up First Republic, acquiring nearly all of the failing bank's deposits and most of its assets. Does this end the banking crisis? And did Jamie once again come out the big winner? We'll debate that. Plus, a weighty move, a deep dive into a pharma name that showered investors with profit in April. Can it keep delivering record-breaking returns? We'll ask the top analyst. And later, with a host of names reporting tomorrow, we take a look at how the options market thinks Starbucks, Ford, Uber, and AMD are going to trade once results cross the tape. I'm Melissa Lee. This is Fast Money. We're live at the Nasdaq Market Site on the desk tonight. Tim Seymour, Karen Feinerman, Courtney Garcia, and Steve Grassa. We start off with the very latest developments on the debt ceiling. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen just minutes ago sending a letter to Congress saying debt limit measures may run out as early as June 1st. That is earlier than anybody expected. Kayla Tausche's got the details. Kayla.
Melissa, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said that June 1st is the date at which the U.S. could default on its debt and be unable to pay its bills unless Congress raises or suspends the debt limit. Now, the new X date, as it's called, is 4 days earlier than Secretary Yellen's prior estimate, and it comes after early assessments of this year's tax revenues. In a letter to congressional leaders, Yellen writes, given the current projections, it is imperative that Congress act as soon as possible to increase or suspend the debt limit in a way that provides longer-term certainty that the government will continue to make its payments. The White House today dug its heels in, demanding Congress raise the debt limit with no strings attached, despite Republican support for budget cuts. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy and President Biden last met on the issue 3 months ago. It remains to be seen which side will blink first, Melissa. Most Wall Street shops estimate that the debt ceiling issue would come to a head in late July or early August. We know Treasury's estimates are always conservative, but this is the new deadline that Washington is going to be working toward.
So this is the new deadline, Kaylin. This also takes into account any extraordinary measures that Treasury could take. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes. Treasury has been taking extraordinary measures since January, when the country first brushed up and surpassed that $31+ trillion debt limit. So it's already been using extraordinary measures for the last several months. It's been prioritizing some of the government programs that it's been funding, some of the contributions it's been making to government employees' retirement accounts, for instance. And there are going to be some other changes in the next few weeks. But Secretary Yellen is warning there really aren't many measures left. And in just the next few weeks, they'll run out of them completely.
Wow. Kayla, thanks. Kayla Tausche from Washington. This is like a month more than what Wall Street had been expecting, Tim. I mean, this has got to, I don't know, scare some people.
Yeah, people were thinking July through September. Yep. You know, this is not a big deal. Anyone who is, sitting in a chair on Wall Street, anywhere in the country in the summer of 2011 remembers what it was like when everybody blinked. In fact, the U.S. lost their AAA in the downgrade. And it was really part of a global sovereign debt reassessment. But this would be horrible. That's needless to say, what's really interesting are the politics behind this. And it's really not what we do on the show. But clearly, if you think about it, you know, GOP kind of pushed the White House's hand in terms of agreeing to, OK, we'll give you a year increase, but you've got to cap spending and you've got to cap a lot of those kind of flagship and some of Biden's biggest pieces of legislation. So, we're digging in here. Market's not pricing it in.
So what divided government looks like. There's no way to revert all this. Just pass the Republican plan for a year. See what happens. Right?
That's it.
Well, 60% of the people in this country, 60% of the people in this country think that the government spends too much money. So this is not a minority that we're talking about. And they're cutting the budget by 9% for a year on $34 trillion in budget. I'm pretty sure they could handle it.
Let's say we live in a world in which Steve Grasso is right. And that everybody does.
We live in a democracy, though. And the Democrats had undivided government. Now they don't.
The problem is that that's probably not going to happen. And that's just the fact of the matter. As rational as you may sound and you may think you sound, it's probably not going to happen. So that's the world we live in.
Right.
So what are the markets going to do?
I think realistically, this is going to come down to the wire. It always does. It's a political football, especially in a year like now where we're going to have elections. This is something that they're going to use. I don't think markets are necessarily going to trade on this until we get pretty darn close to this. So I think this is going to be a conversation at the end of this month. This is not over by any means. But yes, I don't think it's
VIX was, nice VIX was at 1550 at the low today. So in terms of complacency on where markets are, we haven't been here since way back into 2021 before the Fed even embarked upon their plan.
Yeah. Karen.
Well, it is kind of ridiculous. We all know it's going to get to this at the end. Why not just do it now? Right. I mean, the balance of power is going to change early in the next month. But unless they come out with even more ways to delay, and that'll work for a week or two, I really don't get the whole thing. But one other piece of data that my friend Andy Constant sent me from Dam Springs was the deficit is rising more rapidly than we thought, right? Lower tax revenue and higher interest rates. And so the amount of additional bonds that will need to be issued to pay for the deficit, well over $1 trillion now. So the bond market should be pretty spooked. And that came out later today. The bond market's already down this morning, I think, on some of that economic data that I thought was pretty good. But I wonder, though, in a default scenario, I don't remember what happened in 11, actually, but was there a flight to quality?
So even though bonds would go down,
right,
would
there's
you
a
still...
flight to quality. I don't know. Right. I don't remember if somebody knows at me mm-hmm. because I could see that happening. Turmoil in the bond market.
As perverse and therefore as it may seem.
Yes. But right. We're in Steve's world, so maybe that would happen. I don't know.
Well, Steve's world, you got to do something, right? We're all in agreement. You got to do something.
Yes.
And you nailed it, right? The balance of power is not going to change. So maybe the president and McCarthy could possibly meet.
Exactly.
Maybe they should meet. Yeah. The last time I met was early February. So nothing's changing.
I know.
Sit down at the table. So if it's not 9% in cuts, maybe it's 4%. But it's got to be something, and we got to agree on
it.
This
Why
is what democracy is.
I don't know, McCarthy, can you do Wednesday?
Yeah.
Nope.
I'm busy.
June? Let's do it the first week.
Yeah. I have the default.
Have you ever had an assignment?
It's
a paper that you had to write, and you made it to the last minute.
Of course. Right.
All the time.
Nothing's
going to
change,
right?
You could have started 5 days before. It's not like you will know anything more in 5 days.
Right.
But you still wait till the night before.
And you won't even enjoy it.
And that's what the markets do. They wait, as Courtney said, till the night before to see what the real reaction is going to be. And every time we get to this point, I say the same thing. This really feels like the time we're going to default. This really feels like the time we're going to default. And then somehow it works out.
To Karen's point, though, what do you think happens in this world with the bond market?
Well, I'm ready to answer Karen's question because I went to work here when she asked the question. I'm embarrassed. I didn't know it, but I guess nobody else knew it either.
So we went from
3% on the 10-year down to 150. And if you think about it, there were a lot of things going on. And again, to me, what was more significant about that time was Mario Draghi stepped forward in the European Union and actually made a semblance out of chaos in the pigs. So again, Southern Europe, and they were the ones that were about to have the sovereign debt default. We were, doing our thing over here as we're doing and as we're all saying we will continue to do right up to the last minute. But it is a flight to quality on its own level. And at some point, if you own Bitcoin and if you own gold and if you own other diversified assets that are where people expect the world to go at some point, but until the U.S. is not the economy in the world, and again, the most significant economy, if China's number two, and we're talking about China and the world we live in, China's not even close in terms of a bond market and the confidence there.
Using that as a blueprint, then, we have sort of an interesting push-pull situation where the Fed is trying to raise rates and getting rates to go higher, and yet you're saying that the bond market will actually work against the Fed and rates will go lower as a result of this. History is a guide.
I think that's right. Karen also, though, brings up, I think before we get there, flight to quality is what it is, but there are technical factors that have yields going higher. There's no question in terms of issuance. And if you talk to a lot of guys that are really looking at the issuance calendar, this is one of these things that at some point, and the same people that are in favor of Bitcoin and gold are saying, the U.S. is not going to be able to finance their way out of this the way they used to. They're going to be able to do it, but they're not going to be able to do it with the costs being as low as they were.
All right, let's move on now to J.P. Morgan, scooping up First Republic CEO Jamie Dimon, winning control of the failed bank through an FDIC auction this weekend. JP Morgan shares up more than 2% on the day, but gains didn't help the broader banking sector. The KRE banking ETF dropping more than 2%, closing less than 2% from its lows of the year. That's a KBE, excuse me. Regional banks are faring even worse, down almost 3%, less than a buck from its low. So is Jamie Dimon once again emerging as the big winner from the most recent banking crisis. Karen, you seem to think so.
I do. I think this is really an extraordinary deal. I mean, there are so many things to like about it, right? There's so much protection from the FDIC. They get to write down the loans to 87%. They get a loss-sharing agreement for 5 years on residential mortgage, 7 years, I think, on commercial mortgages. I mean, there's so much to like here. I think they were really kind of sandbagging the how good the deal was because they don't want it to seem too good that it is accretive to book, it is accretive to earnings. And then obviously the wealth management business, it's a prize. It's probably a little bit dented from where it was 6 weeks ago, but that could fold very nicely into J.P. Morgan Asset Management. And he looks like a good corporate citizen and sort of solves the crisis. He is the hero.
Once again.
Right. He's always Wang. OTEO. And I'll say anything good about Jamie Dimon.
Yes,
but he always says it wasn't just me. Every other bank was on that call. They all were all in to make deposits. We all did it together. They just called me first, but everybody was working on it.
Everything has his fingerprints all over it. And that, I like that last line. They called him first. They'll go, and they're going to call him first when all the regulatory framework changes as well. And not that he's going to advantage J.P. Morgan more so than other banks, but he's definitely not going to disadvantage J.P. Morgan over other banks either. That's why this is the one trade that I'm holding on to. It benefited him. His stock has outperformed everything in the group.
Yeah. One other thing I just wanted to add, because there is this backstop from the FDIC, plus they give him $50 billion of cheap loans. We didn't get to that. The risk-weighted asset, the weighting for these loans is less than it would normally be, so they can lever up and make more money on it. It's a fantastic deal.
I thought something very interesting was, you know, PNC was in there bidding as well, and yet their stock was treated today as if they were a bank that should be bid for. I mean, if you look at actually some of the banks that were actually at least considered to be on that group, PNC, Citizens Financial, Fifth Third, it wasn't a great day for almost anybody in the banking space other than the money center banks with strength. The regionals sold off some more, and if anything, as Jamie Dimon said, this should solve this situation for now, is kind of what he said, at least the phases of it. I don't think he was auguring or foreboding something that much more ominous, but I do think the point was this should put a nail in the coffin on runs on banks. And yet, again, one of the banks that was in there bidding and claimed to have a competitive bid, they were down 6% today.
Well, one last thing, and I know you want to go to Courtney. The thing that will continue the run of the bank is if the Fed continues to raise rates and people continue to usher money out into money markets. That's the one thing that's the problem. It's not so much what's going on with running in to rescue these banks. It's the fact that the Fed is actually creating the run on the banks.
Mm-hmm. Court.
Yeah, and that's what we're going to see this week is the Fed raising rates by another 25 basis points or not? Because this was happening even before Silicon Valley Bank. People were taking money out. We were getting calls from clients every day asking us to buy treasuries and money market, and they're taking money out. And the banks are going to have to raise interest rates in order to keep their money there, because this was a problem that's not going away, and it gets worse every time the Fed raises interest rates. But when it comes to J.P. Morgan, I agree. I actually think this is really beneficial for them. I think the biggest thing, which Karen mentioned, is this really gets them in the door with the wealth management business. They are really trying to get in the foot for. But they just can't compete with your Merrill Lynch's and your Morgan Stanley's. And suddenly they can compete now because they just gained all of these high net worth assets. And that clientele, so First Republic says, they were still keeping. So I think that'll be interesting to see with them moving forward.
I agree. And it's that wealthy clientele is very important. It was the Bear Stearns prime brokers back in 2008, 2009. I mean, you know, J.P. Morgan is a massive prime broker. They're much different than they were back then. But even with just the Bear Stearns assets, that was, look, Bear Stearns is a PB back then and as a custodian was one of their core businesses. So Jamie Dimon doesn't need to go out there and say, well, this is, you know, we're trying to grow our wealth management business. He can just go in there and say, I've got the capital. FDIC went to us because we have the lowest impact on the cost to them on this solution. But it is, as Courtney, as she's saying, I mean, look, the wealth management business is such great business for J.P. Morgan. It's the one business, if you look at their ivory tower, and it is ivory, is got some places to compete and to get better against the biggest ones in the country.
Well, Morgan Stanley has had an advantage, right?
Right.
In many years because of its wealth management business, which it had built up over time.
But also it's the stock price advantage in that to the extent that it's that part of the business as opposed to the lumpier investment banking or even lending part of the business. But one thing I also want to add, to the extent that there's the notion that is this the end of the crisis, the FDIC has kind of said we're going to insure uninsured deposits. They haven't really There isn't a new regulation
right.
saying that.
Are there proposals saying, you know, business accounts should be able to step up to higher insurance brackets to have more of their deposits insured? So there are a lot of things going around out there, but you got to hope there's not another bank failure.
Right. But you could rest a little easier as a depositor in excess of $250,000
sure.
now, knowing that likely the FDIC will be there.
Well, there's been an implicit backstop this whole time during the banking crisis. Yeah.
But now this is, here we are 6 mm-hmm. weeks later, another one that was and there they are.
Well, they have to. I mean,
they have
there
to.
Is
I
no
agree.
Other.
I agree.
There's no other step that J.P. Morgan will take to save another bank. Who else is going to go in? And this is a one-off. So this is not a solution in a systemic sort of way, and sort of a this is the blueprint for how we solve crises
that
going
JP
forward.
Morgan goes
that
after
Jamie right Dimon then picks up the assets right. with the help of the FDIC.
Yeah, well,
I mean, this is just not a sustainable model.
Yeah.
When Jamie Dimon put together a consortium of banks to give $30 billion or right. lend $30 billion to ultimately back them up, I mean, it goes to show that JP Morgan was in on this. JP Morgan wanted this solution. JP Morgan, the stock, I just want to say, you know, for all the pain and suffering in the banking sector, if you look at JP Morgan against the S&P over the last 12 months, it's outperformed the S&P by 17%. Now, I'm choosing a calendar year. I'm just using 12 months back. You can find different places in the last 2 years where it's really underperformed. But we've been in an environment where it's been Fed heavy. And actually, the worst of JP Morgan's underperformance in the year before that was really as the Fed, as the rate hike cycle began in earnest and was aggressive. And since then, even with higher rates, J.P. Morgan has been outperforming. And, you know, we know what goes on with net interest income. It's getting better, even if the margins are going down.
Yeah. All right. For more on the banking crisis and how it's factoring into the Fed's decision this week, let's bring in Jim Bianco, Bianco Research. Jim, great to have you with us. So we've got the banking crisis going on. We've also got this new X date, which has been moved up significantly to the beginning of June. How do you think this factors into the Fed's decision, if at all?
I don't think it does. I think that the Fed is focused on inflation and they're going to raise rates and they're going to leave the door open to raising rates again in June. Now, I happen to think that's a mistake at this point, but it doesn't matter what I think. That's the way that they've been viewing it. I'll remind everybody that on February 14th, there was a meeting. This came out with the report on Friday to the Board of Governors of the Fed. Jay Powell was there. They were told that the banks were getting unrealized losses and that they were in trouble. And they pointed out a specific bank that was in trouble, Silicon Valley Bank. 3 weeks later, he went to Congress and said, we're going to raise rates aggressively. 24 hours later, they failed. So he's not going to have anything with the banks change his opinion. It's all about inflation. He sees inflation as a problem. He's going to raise rates this week and leave the door open for more rate hikes.
You don't think that the X date gives the Fed a little bit of, I mean, to the extent that monetary policy should help fiscal policy and vice versa, I mean, that's sort of gone hand in hand for many years, that sort of gives them cover at this point, along with the banking crisis, to say, you know what, we're going to have it, there's going to be a dovish hike, so to speak. So a raise, but then we'll see.
Right. Well, I don't think that the X date is going to really matter. Yes, it is a big surprise that it is early June. A lot of people thought it would be around late July or something like that. So that is a surprise. Jay Powell has made it very clear, and I've agreed with him, that the Fed's position about the debt ceiling is to do nothing. This is a 100% political act, and it needs to be solved by Congress without any mitigation by anybody else in terms of trying to fix this. This is Congress's issue. This is not the Fed's issue. This is not anybody else's issue. So I don't think that that's going to change. And he's also talked about fiscal dominance in the past. That's fancy talk for we're not going to let the possibility of a default or big deficits change what we think is the right monetary policy.
Jim, when you look at the two scenarios, either the Fed continues to raise rates and continues to break something, or they don't, inflation continues higher. Those two scenarios, won't inflation, high prices, won't high prices save themselves from other future high prices? Take me down just really quickly. If he does nothing, what's the difference?
Well, I think the way that he looks at it is that 57% of the public, and this is a recent survey by Bankrate, lives paycheck to paycheck. They couldn't come up with $1,000 in savings. So he looks at a 5 or 6% inflation rate and says, these people lose. I have to do something about inflation. If a bunch of rich people in stocks have to suffer because I'm raising rates too much, then a bunch of rich people in stocks have to suffer because I'm raising too much. He's not going to say to the 57% that live paycheck to paycheck, sorry, you're just going to have to deal with having prices rise faster than your paycheck because I can't let the stock market go to 3,500 or whatever the bearish scenario you want. He doesn't look at it that way. That's why he's focused on inflation. And that's the dilemma. If he focuses a lot on inflation, then financial markets could struggle. If he appeases financial markets, he lets inflation go. And he's viewing it from that 57% versus stockholders. That's, he's made that clear in a lot of his press conferences and a lot of his speeches.
Last quick question, Jim. Let's say we hit the debt ceiling or about to hit the debt ceiling. What happens to bonds?
What usually happens around June 1st is all the Treasury bills that mature on that date, people will avoid them and there'll be a big hump in the yield curve because if you don't get paid on those bonds, your money market fund has to value it at zero, even if it's for 1 or 2 days and it could break the buck. So no one wants to be in a position to break the buck. So you're going to see wild gyrations in the Treasury bill market. And it's probably more of a headache for money market mutual fund managers than anything else. I don't think it creates a bid for the 10-year or creates a sell-off for the 10-year or anything like that.
All right, Jim, thank you. Jim Bianco, Bianco Research. Well, I mean, if the Fed says, you know what, it's a political problem, we're going to leave Congress. I mean, I don't know if anybody has much faith in Congress to actually solve this thing, but that really leaves the markets in a sort of a lurch because you're not going to get any help.
Well, we want our central bank to be independent.
Sure,
let's be clear.
Of course.
You know, it's not independent in Turkey. So they got a different situation going on. The Fed that's really got a dual mandate of core inflation against unemployment, if you look at kind of two different axes, you've got a dynamic where I just think that they have to still continue to lean on inflation. We forget that today we had an ISM number, manufacturing. We know we're a service economy. We know manufacturing is kind of what it is. But it was only, you know, take out COVID lows, and this was the lowest ISM we've had since going all the way back to the financial crisis. I mean, the numbers right now, the leading indicators tell you the economy is not in a good place. And the labor market figures we've gotten, even in terms of jobless claims and whatnot, have been showing a weakening labor market. So the economy's weakening. We know that. And I just think that we haven't really seen it in the stock market.
Coming up, we're watching MGM in the after-hour session. Shares on the move after reporting results. We've got the details from the quarter next. Plus, get your passports ready. We're going international. How markets in Europe and Asia are faring against stocks here at home. The countries to watch straight ahead. Don't go anywhere. Fast Money's back in two.
You seek the key, but first, you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones, from powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY, a big idea that inspired the world to invest differently, and still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Earnings alert on MGM shares adding to the day's winnings after turning in a beat on the top and the bottom lines. The stock had closed at more than 52-week highs in the regular session. Contessa Brewer has the latest from the conference call. Contessa.
Yeah, MGM's Macau earnings, Melissa, may be enough to entice investors to double down here. Revenues nearly 50% higher than the estimates. It's all-important earnings metric, adjusted property EBITDA, more than double the estimates. On the call, CEO Bill Hornbuckle said it's one of the best quarters ever. He pointed to a big jump in market share in Macau since the pandemic, from 9.4% to 15.4%, and said he expects to keep that share because MGM China has been awarded a third more tables in the concession process, and right now only about half are in use. Domestic operations. The Vegas Strip came in with a record first quarter result for MGM. Increased profit margin driven higher by revenue per available room. And the average daily rate is at 31% over last year, and they said on the call that the bookings are up every month through November. Regional casinos, steady. MGM expanding its international footprint. Its European subsidiary, LeoVegas, announced today it's acquiring game developer Push Gaming. And then, of course, the focus on developing that new casino resort in Osaka, Japan. It's clear that this is a company that is intending to use its free cash flow and reinvest it, Melissa, to make its international footprint even greater than it already is.
All right. Contessa, thanks. Contessa Brewer. Casinos overall had a pretty good day, Tim, up 1%, and then MGM was up 2.5%.
So. MGM is, I think, the most diversified casino play in there, in that their Macau business is now a lot more than a rounding error. They have a digital footprint, certainly an online sports betting that's become meaningful in an industry that started to actually get price rationalization, and the competitive forces are calming down a little bit. Las Vegas Strip's been very important. The numbers out of Macau, though, if you looked at gross gaming revenue that came out last night, up 449% year over year. Now, I realize China was largely closed, but up 15% sequentially from March. So if you think about what's going on, anybody that's got core exposure over there, and this is, to me, Las Vegas Sands, how I've been playing it for a long time, and I bought some Melco today because Melco Crown is that core play. And so we've gotten the license issues around the renewals, we've got VIP, we've gotten all the things that I think build into that story, and I think there's more to come.
Karen?
Yeah, so I am in MGM, and, you know, when I got into it, I liked it for its not being so heavily weighted in China, and getting into the online, and that Las Vegas would come back. And however, with what's happening in China now, it's not an albatross. It's great they have some exposure there and that it's really doing well. But if you really want to be turbocharged, I think you got to be
Vegas.
Where Tim is.
Vegas Sands. Yeah, sorry, LVS, as in Las Vegas Sands. Yeah.
Which,
I mean, the only thing negative about this, so obviously Las Vegas Sands and Wynn have an outsized dependency and leverage towards Macau. MGM is leveraged here, and they're building that leverage. They're also dipping into online more and more because it's tougher. It's tougher to build out the footprint of what's already there. It's tougher to get these licenses. So they're everywhere where the growth is. The problem is, if we go into a recession, how much does that hurt where they're weighted the most, which is Vegas? So that's the chart looks excellent. For the last year, chart looks excellent. The 50-day broke above the other longer-term moving averages. Everything on a technical basis looks great. I'm almost thinking it looks too good. It's sitting right on the 50. Maybe you wait a little bit to see how the recession pans out for new money.
We got some breaking news. We're going to get to D.C. and Kayla Tausche with the details. Kayla.
Melissa, President Biden has spoken with all four congressional leaders from both parties and set a meeting for May 9th to discuss the debt limit. That is a week from tomorrow. Now, this comes as House Speaker Kevin McCarthy is traveling in Jerusalem as the House is out of session this week. But it also gives the White House and Democrats a little bit of time to come up with their plan to counter what Republicans passed last week. That bill raised the debt limit into 2024, but also introduced some across-the-board spending cuts and reversed many of Biden's signature policies. Democrats so far up until this point have argued that there should be nothing attached to the debt limit. It should be raised with no strings attached and that the budget process should proceed separately. We will see if they can cobble together a counteroffer in the coming days or if they'll continue digging in their heels. Melissa?
Kayla, thank you. Kayla Tausche. By the way, President Biden is set to host a reception within the hour. This is a live picture of the East Room. We'll be monitoring the event in case he does make some comments on these new developments regarding the debt ceiling, the X date being moved up by Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen to the beginning of June, as opposed to what many on Wall Street had expected, which was sometime in July or even August. So we will monitor this happens, bring you any developments as they do. It's getting real, Courtney. I mean, May 9th, that's next week, but then 3 weeks later is the X date.
Yeah, and people were expecting we had another month or two, realistically. I would be shocked if actually anything happens May 9th. That would be wonderful. But I think realistically, it's just going to be another headline. This is going to get pushed until the end of the month, at least. So I think it's going to be a continuing story.
All right, there's a lot more fast money to come. We'll be right back.
What does it mean to be rich? Maybe it's less about reaching a magic number and more about discovering the magic in life. At Edward Jones, our dedicated financial advisors are the people you can count on for financial strategies that help support a life you love. Because the key to being rich is knowing what counts. Learn more about our comprehensive approach to planning at edwardjones.com/findyourrich. Edward Jones, member SIPC.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Japanese markets in rally mode today. The Nikkei crossing 29,000 to hit an 8-month high, while the broader TOPIX index surged by 1%, touching its highest level since September 2021. This as the yen fell to a nearly 2-month low. European markets were closed for the May Day holiday today, but those stocks also went a tear in 2023. French and German indices posting gains of more than 14% each, and the Euro stocks 50 up almost 11% since January, all outpacing the S&P 500's 8.5% gain since the start of the year. Of course, new leader at the top of the BOJ, Tim.
Yeah, it's a combination of currency dynamics and what's going on internationally, and I think asset allocation. And you know, someone that spent most of his career on the international side of things, I think some of this is very sustainable, not just, you know, some of a trend. In fact, you've seen the underperformance of the Euro Stoxx 50 against the S&P. So they're Dow 50, basically, the biggest and the most bulletproof companies in Europe, finally after a decade of underperformance to the S&P in the summer of last year and even in October as the dollar was topping out, started to outperform. So I think companies that are paying an growing cash yield and dividend yield in the international arena, and I work, full disclosure, I work on an ETF that does just that. You know, where else would you want to be to have some part of your money as the world is looking for value and also cash flow?
And I think a lot of people don't realize how well Europe has actually been doing. Specifically, France is your best developed market year to date. It's about 19%. And a lot of that is just benefiting from, they have a lot of luxury goods, and China reopening is really benefiting from that. When you look at Europe and Japan, I think they're a great buy right now. When you look at an earnings relative basis, it's about 30% cheaper than the U.S. right now, especially as we have this 15-year uptrend on the dollar, which to your point, it looks like it's starting to reverse. That's only going to be a positive for Europe as you move forward. So I think you definitely want to continue to look there.
All right. Coming up, earnings season in full swing, and options traders are getting in on the action, how they're playing the results ahead, plus some hefty gains for one pharma stock, that name hitting another all-time high today. It's up 18% in just the past month. We'll tell you what it is when Fast Money returns. Welcome back to Fast Money. Stocks losing steam into the close. The Dow down nearly 50 points. The S&P virtually unchanged, and the Nasdaq falling 0.1%. And some more earnings movers. Chegg tumbling hard despite an earnings beat. The EdTech company issuing a disappointing outlook. Shares down more than 30%. NXP Semi, on the other hand, beating expectations up 4%. Car rental company Avis posting a massive earnings beat, but shares right now are flat. Meantime, check out Eli Lilly breaking out to a fresh all-time high today. The drug manufacturer is up 18% in the last month, thanks in part to the success of its obesity drug, Mounjaro. Joining us now for more on the stock's big run and what could drive the results even further, as well as Fargo Securities biotech analyst Mohit Bansal. He has got a buy rating and a $440 price target on Lilly, just upgraded the stock a month ago or so. Mohit, great to have you with us. Can you help us understand what part of the valuation in your model is Mounjaro and what part of it is Alzheimer's and the promise of Alzheimer's?
Thank you for having me. So my model mostly is driven by Mounjaro, and Alzheimer's is a small part of the business in my model. I would say it's probably contributing 10 to 15%, not more than that. It's pretty much driven by Mounjaro at this point.
So basically later on this year, when Eli Lilly is expected to give a readout of the Alzheimer's results, if that's positive, that could just be upside to the stock that's not factored in at this point.
Right. I would agree with that. I think at least 10% upside when Eli Lilly shows Alzheimer's data in first half of the year. So probably in a couple of months at this point.
Can you help us understand how Mounjaro stacks up right now in your view with Wegovy and some of the others out there in terms of, you know, what is driving it right now? Has it been production issues with some of the other drugs that are now cleared up? And so how is that sort of playing out? I'm just trying to understand what exactly has driven the uptake and what will continue driving the uptake going forward.
So I would say it is pretty much demand driven right now. The demand is such for these products, and it's for right reasons, because Mounjaro, if you look at the weight loss profile, if you look at the diabetes or glycemic control profile of the drug, it is much better than what we have seen with any of the drugs. So just to give numbers here, Mounjaro among obese patients, it showed as high as 22% weight loss, and among diabetes and obese patients, showed Last week, it showed about 16% weight loss. That's unheard of. That's not something that other drugs do. And that's why it is, the demand is such that even Mounjaro is running into supply issues. Other agent, Wegovy, has improved its supply, and so did Mounjaro as well. Because this quarter call, people were worried about going into the quarter call and worried about that whether supply would whether they can meet the numbers or beat the numbers, and they actually did beat it, which basically tells you that the least supply is improving at this point.
It's Karen. Thanks so much for being on. When they get to full production and that's no longer sort of an obstacle, what do you think the coverage will be? How big of a hurdle is that? What are you expecting from insurers, the government, regarding covering either Mounjaro, tirzepatide, in whatever form?
Right. So for now, it would be a while before they get to a position where supply is not an issue, because by the end of the year, they are still looking at doubling the supply. So probably that demand would probably be more than that. But eventually, I think the biggest obstacle is Medicare, especially for obesity, because half of the obesity patients are Medicare, and Medicare doesn't cover it. I think that hurdle would be removed once Novo has a trial which is looking at whether reducing this weight among obese patients results into cardiovascular benefit. That trial is also reading out sometime in the middle of the year, and that, if that turns out to be positive, that is going to be one of the important trials which actually removes that obstacle, because then these are not just weight loss drugs. These are the drugs which reduce your weight and actually help you live longer or maybe have a better cardiovascular benefit longer term.
Have you, Mohit, or when do you start thinking about, you know, people take these drugs, they're not obese, they may not develop diabetes, it may, you know, reduce the severity of the diabetes and therefore reduce all these other side effects down the road, and what the impact is on other drugs and other sales of other drugs that can treat some of those things that will now be prevented?
I mean, that would be a dream scenario. I think we are still ways away from that particular scenario playing out. But eventually, I mean, like if you give it to pre-diabetic patients, probably diabetes can be pushed out. Obesity is supposed to be cause of many other diseases down the line, including cancers. So that would be a scenario that could play out. But I think we are probably maybe 10 years or more than that away from that.
10 years. Okay. Thank you. Mohit, great to speak with you. Mohit Bansal.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so where do we stand on Lilly here at all-time highs?
I'll tell you, it's hard to turn away from a stock that's made so much money. We've been long our clients, and it's, you know, but at 44 times current year, it's really tough here. And again, so much has been priced in to Mounjaro and the addressable market. We don't really know where it is. I look at the dynamic here on valuation relative to a peer group, and not everybody has the pipeline at all. It's all about the growth here and where you're more excited. But I think I'd be starting to fade this.
Courtney?
Yeah, and I do like the pharmaceuticals in general. I think this is something that was a little underappreciated earlier this year, and people are starting to come back in. I do think it's valued a little higher than I like to see it. I would almost like something like a Merck, which is a lot less expensive. They still have a lot in their pipeline moving forward. But the pharmaceuticals as a whole, I think, is definitely something somewhere you want to be.
The problem is when you look at Eli Lilly's chart, Tim alluded to this, it's been on fire since February 2022, and it based basically at 237, took off when they approved their COVID treatment, then it based at 310, and now it's still off to the races. So when do you bet against it? Yes, multiples are looking a bit expensive right now, but I say go XBI.
The stock's going up four times since the last
crazy
5 years, though. I mean, like, why own Bitcoin when you can own Lilly? I mean, it's been staggering.
And it seems like it's best in breed. It seems like they're treating it as best in breed. But the other thing that hasn't moved is XBI. So it's the ETF for small cap biotech. If all of these other pharmaceutical names, the behemoths, are going to have to start buying pipelines, then some of these are going to have to start getting taken out. Just look at Prometheus. What happened to that stock? That's going to happen again with smaller
companies. Some of you, that is a big risk, though, if all these big, I mean, I guess if you're buying the targets and you're going to buy a broad index, you may not get the boost from being a specific target. But here, Karen, I mean, you said it. Alzheimer's is just, that's an option here. I mean, that if it's positive later on this year when they have the phase 3 readout, then great. But right now, it's really nothing in
the
valuation.
I don't know what it should be. I think that's a reasonable sort of conservative really driving this story, though, is, right,
yeah,
is Mounjaro. So, I mean, I sold it early, bought it well, but sold it too early. I don't know. I'm sort of wondering, is given those numbers, that 22% is better than Ozempic and Wegovy. So maybe, I don't know, long, Lilly, short, Novo Nordisk, which is really, it's their only, not their only, it's the bulk of their business by a
right.
lot.
Coming up, another big week of earnings, and the options pits are pointing to some big action ahead of the results. The names to watch next. And throughout May, CNBC is celebrating Asian American Pacific Islander heritage. Here's the president and CEO of Ancestry.
I grew up in a small town in South Carolina, one of the very few Asians in the state. And I grew up going to football games and eating hot dogs and going to state fairs. And I love that. And yet at home, I learned a different language. We ate different foods. And marrying those things together, being able to share that with others, that's such an important part of what it means to be an Asian American. And I'm so proud of that. But that's also why I'm part of Ancestry and I joined this company to help people discover, craft, and connect around their family history, because we all bring the experiences that we have, our cultures, our history, and make this country as rich as it is because we can bring it all together.
Do not miss Uber CEO Dara Khosrowshahi on Squawk Box tomorrow, 7:30 a.m. to discuss the company's Q1 results. That's right here on CNBC. Well, Uber is just one of the many earnings headliners tomorrow. The ride-hailing company joining Starbucks, Ford, and AMD on the slate. The options market is betting on some big moves when these names report. Mike Coe's got the action. Mike.
Yeah, we are indeed seeing some big implied moves for all of these. AMD is going to be reporting, looking at a 7.5% move in that one. Ford, 5.5%. Starbucks, 5%. And Uber, 8.5%. I'm looking at Starbucks. This one traded more than 1.5 times its average daily put volume and almost 2 times its average daily call volume in the busiest call contract with a June 115 calls. We did see some two-way flow, but I saw an institutional buyer paying 520 for 500 about 15 minutes before the close. Overall, we saw just shy of 20,000 of those trading.
Tim, you are a shareholder. You are an angry
consumer,
customer.
I'm a disgruntled.
Complaining of pricing.
There's inflation.
But that's exactly why you own it.
It is. And I'm not sure they're going to be able to hold these prices and certainly hold these margins because they've been extraordinary, especially in North America. We talk about maybe the risk of some of their China growth. I look at the chart and the RSI on Starbucks, a 9-day RSI, and we talk about relative strength indicators only because they give you some sense of just how overbought a company is. But for the last month, this company's been north of 80 on an RSI, and it's trading at 88. It's never been this high valuation. It's tough for me, even though I'm still long just a little bit.
And paying $7 for a black
coffee. More than, sure.
Mike, thanks. Mike Coe for more options action. Tune into the full show. That's Friday, 5:30 p.m. Eastern time. Coming up, GM driving higher. The stock getting a boost as one analyst revs up his rating. So could shares be about to turn a corner? We'll trade that when Fast Money returns. Welcome back to Fast Money. Time for our call of the day. GM shares hitting the gas as Morgan Stanley's auto analyst Adam Jonas upgraded the site. It's very clever. He upgraded the stock to an overweight from an under equal weight, raised his price target to $38, over 13% higher than today's close. Jonas said the market has sufficiently discounted the challenges to making money in EVs. Separately, GM announced hundreds of layoffs today, primarily from its engineering hub in Detroit as the latest cost-cutting measure. You guys were all psyched to talk about this one on the call. Karen, why?
Some love maybe for GM. It's the Rodney Dangerfield of the auto space for sure. I love Adam Jonas as an analyst. This is a kind of a big turnaround for him. I believe last year he had the ICE, the internal combustion engine business, at zero, I think. And so that it's a melting ice cube, as Tim pointed out.
Very clever, Adam.
Very clever.
I'm not surprised.
It's happening a lot more slowly. The margins are Tesla-like in that business, but you know, clearly all eyes are now on the EV, even though they got this enormous, successful, huge, profitable business. I still like it here, but I've liked it for a long time.
We're big Jonas fans. I think he's pointing out that Mary Barra can run this company as efficiently as any, that they will be paying attention to what they spend on EV. And I would argue that when EV multiples were even a little bit priced into a Ford and obviously in Tesla, GM didn't participate that on the way up. And they're participating on the way down. And it's crazy. So his point on the melting ice internal combustion engine is that they're going to generate tens of billions in profits and in free cash flow in the next decade from that business.
15 seconds. Would you rather Tesla or GM?
Tesla. No brainer. Tesla, after getting bombarded with sell side, is still up 32% year to date. GM is flat. And GM and Ford are both going to have to be pushed into cutting prices the way that Tesla did.
Up next, final trade. For the final trade, Tim.
Mel, Disney owns a sports network, right?
It
What's
does.
That called?
ESPN.
Wow. Big game seven. Let's go Rangers tonight. Go Disney.
Karen?
I got to go with JP Morgan. Very nice deal.
Of course. Courtney?
Of course. Starbucks, I think, actually had earnings. I think we'll continue to see some pricing pressure here.
Steve?
UNH. The stock is prone to have big ups, big downs. As of late, I'm a shareholder. It's had tremendous downs. I'm looking at the chart now. It looks like it sort of stemmed the losses, expecting higher prices going forward. UNH.
All right. Thank you for watching Fast Money. We'll see you back here tomorrow at 5 for more Fast. Meantime, do not go anywhere. Mad Money with Jim Cramer starts right now.
All opinions expressed by the Fast Money participants are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of CNBC, NBC Universal, their parent company or affiliates, and may have been previously disseminated by them on television, radio, internet, or another medium. You should not treat any opinion expressed on this podcast as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of an opinion. Such opinions are based upon information the Fast Money participants consider reliable, but neither CNBC nor its affiliates and or subsidiaries warrant its completeness or accuracy, and it should not be relied upon as such. To view the full Fast Money disclaimer, please visit cnbc.com/Fast Money Disclaimer.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.